KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through our public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Pacific Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, PG&E blacks out most of San Francisco. Is it time for them to pack up and leave town? Also, our weekly segment, Genocide Watch with Sam Husseini. This week, Sam delves into the Epstein role in Israel's funding of U.S. covert actions. And was Noam Chomsky kicking it with Epstein? Also, Gaza Poems of Genocide by Rilke, translator and poet Anita Barrows. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We now begin the show with a look back at last weekend. Major blackout in San Francisco. What the hell happened? A lot of people talk and say a lot about it, but we really wanted to get to Tim Redman of 48 Hills, who's been on top of this. Although, Tim, you escaped the blackout.
Oddly, because we had a blackout about a week before when our entire block went out. Oddly, the block I'm on in Vernal Heights did not get blacked out. It was about a week before where I needed the Wi-Fi for something and we had no power, but you know, I had to use I actually have an emergency backup battery that I keep in the house because PG&E is so unreliable.
Well, congratulations for that forethinking. Let's get your best take. Do we know what went wrong exactly? What happened in the short and the long of it?
Okay. The short of it is a substation in the Mission caught fire. And it took them, 72 hours to fix it. Right? fire department put out the fire, but apparently was somewhat delayed in getting there because all of the Waymos were stranded and the fire department couldn't get there. Anyway, they put out the fire. It took them a long time. Now, they're supposed to have redundancy in the system. One fire at one transformer is not supposed to shut down a third of the city. Right? That's not supposed to happen. The long of it is, the long term is, PG&E has a long history of diverting money that the state approved for resiliency, upgrades, maintenance, et cetera, and diverting it to executive bonuses. That was one of the scandals after all the wildfires, that they had given PG&E money for tree trimming and maintenance of the line so this wouldn't happen, and they had diverted it to executive bonuses. So PG&E has not maintained its equipment very well over the years. It's, you know, that's I think this is just another example of that.
And what are the politics of that? Was this about one company versus another, refusals to consider the broader picture, the nature of deterioration? How can we understand this? And maybe if we have to, God forbid, assign blame.
It's clearly PG&E. I mean, they have, as I say, diverted money. They've taken money that was supposed to be used and that could be used for system maintenance and diverted it to executive bonuses and, of course, higher return for shareholders and higher stock prices, which, you know, they claim they need because after bankruptcy, their stock wasn't doing so well. But, yes, that's exactly what happened. You know, I'll tell you a funny story about this just really quickly. I used to study martial arts with a guy who was a PG&E lineman. And his job, he was like a firefighter. His job was they'd sit around and they'd do trainings and sometimes they'd just hang out. And when something went wrong, when something blew up or a line fell or something, they'd jump into their trucks and they'd go and fix it, right? It's like firefighters do. They sit around in the station until there's a fire, right? So he told me that one day some hotshot young MBA executive from PG&E walked into the room where all these guys were sitting around and said, "What are you all doing?" And they said, "Well, we're reading training manuals and practicing, but basically we're waiting for something to go wrong so we can go and fix it." And he shook his head like that was a horrible waste of everyone's time, and a bunch of them just got laid off. Right? that's kind of the attitude that we've seen at PG&E is, you know, divert money to the top and to the shareholders at the expense of protecting people. And I'm not just saying this has been widely reported after the wildfires.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Tim Redman of 48 Hills. We're talking about the fact that most of San Francisco was hit by a major blackout this past weekend. I imagine, John, I don't know if you've heard anything about the implications, but I imagine there was great loss. It was a financial hit at a lot of different levels. It's a lot of restaurants had major problems. And it was also interesting to know that what's the driverless car service stopped in the middle of the street. Waymo stopped everywhere. Did you notice that?
Yes. Everywhere. And apparently, according to at least one city supervisor, apparently the stalled Waymos slowed down emergency responders who were trying to respond to fires, slowed down the fire, including the fire department personnel who were going to put out the fire at the substation, were slowed down because they couldn't get past the Waymos. Now, again, that's what Supervisor Bilal Mahmood says, is that there were, but this is, this is so many different things here. If you have, PG&E is supposed to have a redundant enough system that if one thing goes wrong, something else kicks in, right? They're supposed to have enough repair people on duty that they can fix this stuff pretty quickly. Waymo is supposed to be able to pull over to the side of the road when something went wrong. They didn't. They just stopped in the middle of the street. Right? These are all, and you know, you just think, this was one fire in one transformer in the Mission District. Imagine a major earthquake when all the power goes down, all the Waymos are frozen, there's no cell phone service, the first responders can't get through, and PG&E's system is not sufficiently redundant to handle an emergency. That's what we saw here. We cannot trust this private utility whose interest primarily is return on investment for shareholders to put enough money into system redundancy and upgrades to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen. And that is why so many people at City Hall are talking about we just have to get rid of them and have public power.
Are there any politicians running around saying, "I knew this was going to happen"?
Well, I've been saying that in my book.
What happened here at the political level? How does the politics of the city integrate into this?
What's happening at the political level is the calls for the city to take over PG&E's grid, upgrade it, have a public power system, are getting louder. We're hearing from people, you know, State Senator Scott Wiener was on the Board of Supervisors. He was never a huge public power guy. Now he is. Now he's talking about this. We're hearing about this from, there's going to be hearings at the Board of Supervisors. We're hearing a lot of talk about this. And, you know, it's high time. It's way overdue. San Francisco, there's many, many cities that run their own municipal power systems. And not only do they make money, the systems are safer and better managed because it's not all about profit for shareholders. It's about public service. So I don't know. I don't know where Mayor Lurie is. Mayor Lurie has not said anything except I've been on the phone with PG&E. They're doing their best. He has not come out and said, it's time to move to take over the system. That is in process.
And
basically,
yes.
Go ahead.
And again, is there a vision for that? Are there people waiting in the wings? You mentioned other cities. I'm wondering, it would seem to me that there must be some forward-thinking people in these parts who have been looking around and are ready to do this, to make this kind of change, if you will, to move into the next millennium.
Yeah, no, there definitely are. I mean, former Supervisor Tom Amiano was on this for many, many years. Pushed for this, got a ballot measure that almost won. The Bay Guardian obviously pushed for this for many years. Now, Dennis Herrera, who is the head of the city's Public Utilities Commission, is calling for this. He's actually asked the California Public Utilities Commission to study how much the system in San Francisco is worth. Because what we'll have to do is we'll have to condemn it by eminent domain and buy it. Right? And we can issue revenue bonds to do that. The finances of this are not difficult. The PUC is dragging its feet, maybe because Gavin Newsom told them to, whatever, but basically we're waiting for an estimate from the CPUC on what PG&E's system in San Francisco is worth. And at that point, unless the mayor disagrees, former mayor was on board with this, London Breed, Dennis Herrera is on board with this, I think a lot of supervisors are on board with this, it's now a question of simply announcing to PG&E that we are taking your system by eminent domain. That's how you do this when you municipalize a utility. You take it by eminent domain. We have to pay them fair market value, which is nothing compared to the money that will come out of this. The time I ran the numbers, I looked at, you know, $2.1 billion, which is what PG&E said your system was worth at one point. And if we, first of all, none of that comes from the taxpayers. We sell revenue bonds on Wall Street to do this. The revenue comes from the money that we make selling retail electricity. And my estimate is you end up $600-700 million a year to the good. The city ends up making a profit, so to speak, of $600-700 million a year, even after we pay the interest on the bonds to buy out the system at $2 billion. The system is probably worth less than that now. So there's no financial reason that we can't do this. And there are cities, you know, there's a couple thousand cities in the country that have municipal power. The state of Nebraska has only public power. Private electric utilities are banned in the state of Nebraska. So it's not as if people don't know how to do it.
I'm wondering, Tim, before we let you go, that we see an extraordinary thing happening in New York City, where I happen to come from. You may have heard they have a new mayor, and he's got an amazing array of visions, you know, for doing things that actually are good for the people. I'm wondering if there will be any of that kind of exchange, influence, inspiration, to see that if you can do it in New York City, you can do it anywhere.
Oh, I certainly hope so, and I certainly hope that plays out with raising taxes on the very wealthy, which he's talking about doing in New York City. Again, you know, according to data I got from the IRS, if we just taxed the 4,000 richest people in San Francisco at the amount they saved from the Trump tax cuts, we would have about $750 million a year in addition to our current budget. No budget deficit, no crisis for Muni. That's just 4,000 people. So I'm hoping that is. And it's interesting that, you know, New York is still under Con Edison, I believe. You're from New York. I believe that's the case. But Long Island, most of Long Island has the Long Island Public Power Authority, which is 20-30% cheaper than Con Edison. So there's a model there.
Wow. All right. Well, Tim Redmond, as always, we appreciate the good information, the great reporting at 48 Hills. People should check it out. And Tim, what's your best email if people want to get right to you? They got something hot they need to share.
Tim at 48hills.org.
Beautiful. Okay. Thanks, Tim. Be safe.
All right.
Watch out for those red lights in Dimes. That is the funniest thing. I went out and looked at that, and it was extraordinary. The angles towards the red lights and just stopped. They went on strike. Talk to you later, Tim.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are going to turn our attention back to the ongoing genocide, the repression, the dying that continues at a fast pace, both by weaponry and by the situation created by the genocide over the last how many days. We'll be right back. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Ferencine. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Again, we call it Flashpoints on KPFA Pacifica Radio. Proud to be the People's Radio Network. Joining us again for our weekly coverage of Gaza. We've been calling it Genocide Watch. Is Sam Husseini. Sam, just to be technical about this, do we have the right, are we overstating the case when we call a genocide watch? Are we still watching a genocide?
I think we are watching the genocide. I think it's continuing at a slower rate in Gaza, certainly. And I think we're looking at what made it possible, what makes it possible, and what could possibly stop it. Just today you had, I didn't quite expect this, you had Belgium join the genocide case initiated by South Africa at the International Court of Justice. So you're even having, fairly significant NATO country join in depicting what Israel has been doing and what it's continuing to be doing as genocide. That's, a rare bit of good news, but it is there. What I think we're seeing is Israel consolidating to an extent, and I think that there are multiple reasons for that at this point. You had the Trump phony ceasefire announcement, I guess in October. We've had 400 Palestinians killed outright by Israel during this so-called ceasefire in Gaza. Perhaps even more significantly, in a sense, in recent days, you've had outright announcements by Israel that it plans on consolidating, taking control of some 58% of Gaza. So they've, for 2 years, they bombed and moved and ethnically cleansed Palestinians repeatedly, destroyed the infrastructure, hospitals, schools, churches, mosques, etc. People are living in tents amid garbage. You're having cases of babies dying of basically heat deprivation. The last 2 weeks or so, Israel isn't allowing any significant amount of reconstruction back into Gaza. You still have warnings of starvation by the relevant UN agencies. And at the same time, Israel is escalating violence in the West Bank, the other major part of Palestinian territory that that Israel occupies. And we're seeing a lot of activity, actually. And, you know, you'd think that this would be grabbing headlines around Bethlehem. You know, several teenagers have been killed there by the Israeli military, increasing land grabs, so-called settlement expansion around Jerusalem, as well as Israel saying that it's going to be doing more of these things and saying that you had a minister yesterday saying that they're not going to give up any territory in Syria. Israel has taken more Syrian land over the last year and continued killing in Lebanon, where there was supposed to be a ceasefire since Thanksgiving of the year before last, but Israel's violated it literally thousands of times. So, and
so I'm going to take that as a yes. It's still a genocide.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think that people, you know, I mean, there is a reduction in violence, but I think that it's also manipulative in the sense of the decreasing coverage. Of a lot of what I'm talking about, and I think that that's very intentional and manipulative. To some extent, I wouldn't be shocked, and I put out some tweets about this a couple of weeks ago, where I thought that you remember Trump had his, you know, some rhetoric around Venezuela, and of course they have killed people on the boats in Venezuela and illegally stolen oil tankers and so on and so forth. I don't mean to belittle the violence and threats that the U.S. is conducting towards Venezuela, and I think perhaps no small part because, you know, Venezuela and Colombia have been among the stronger countries regarding Israel, as well as for obvious reasons, oil and, you know, not wanting a socialist country to prosper. But I sensed at the time and said so that that it was sort of a distraction, that it was one reason for it. That you threaten on one thing to distract from another thing. And Trump is the master distractor, right? So they did that, I think, to an extent, especially, you know, during Christmas, where you have a, you know, majority of the American public that, you know, says that they're Christian or claims to be Christian or whatever it is. You'd think that there would be some cognition on a mass scale about the increased violence around Bethlehem and Jerusalem. And you do have a Latin patriarch, I should say. I give credit where credit is due. I mean, this guy was almost Pope. The Latin patriarch, he's Italian, but he's, you know, stationed in Jerusalem, Pizzobole, and he's made some fairly strong statements, including something that seemed like a rebuke to Trump. He quoted Jeremiah saying, those who say peace, peace, when there is no peace, I felt was kind of a rebuke to Trump, you know, claiming that he had, you know, brought peace to the Middle East and all of this nonsense. So, you know, that's some of what I see going on now. And Israel's actually gotten a silver lining from all of this. There was recently an arms fair, if you want to call it that, and they were almost bragging, you know, that all of the weaponry that they are selling has been, you know, battle tested, so-called battle tested, our equipment works because we've actually used it to slaughter Palestinians. So getting other countries to scoop up all the great technology that they're offering.
Yeah. Listen, let me jump in here, let people know you're listening to Flashpoints. We do Genocide Watch with Sam Husseini on a regular basis, covering various aspects of the ongoing genocide, and we consider that the dying is terrible, and the people who are just being left out in the cold, that's the whole of the world. But I want to transition here, Sam, because you've been doing a lot of thinking about the Epstein and the Israelis in the context of this scandal, and it also brings us to the bigger story of the, you know, the Israelis providing the covert action infrastructure for the United States in other parts of the world, and just the connection, the Epstein-Israel connection, is crucial. I don't even know which way to come into that room, but why don't you maybe set the scene of why we want to be talking about genocide, Israel, Palestine, in the context of Epstein.
Sure. You're seeing a lot of coverage now, a lot of discussion among members of Congress about the Epstein case, and you'd think it would be a good thing, but it's leaving out such important components, and it's kind of mind-boggling that it's leaving them out. And I'm even talking about not even just your run-of-the-mill member of Congress. The majority of Congress voted to get the Epstein files released, quote-unquote, and the release has been very limited and possibly manipulated to date. But even the leading members of Congress, like Ro Khanna and Thomas Massie, who are depicted as, those who are more critical of Israel and are more adamant about releasing the Epstein files, even they will not do certain things. Most obviously, they will not talk about Wexner, who was the money behind Epstein. He was the head of, among other products, Victoria's Secret, and gave Epstein his, you know, huge mansion in Manhattan, complete with a video control room and so on. And members of Congress will talk about the billionaires around Epstein, but they won't name them. And I've searched through their Twitter feeds and documented that they're not talking about Wexner, which is just simply remarkable. He's a huge booster of Israel. He was one of the founding members of the so-called mega group that for years has funded all kinds of pro-Israeli projects and so on, and he's basically a huge figure in Columbus, Ohio. There's a huge art center named after him, sports complexes named after him, huge thing at the University of Ohio, and so on. So the fact that they continue to be silent on him, including there have been stories after story coming out recently in outlets like Dropsite News, further clarifying what was already known, but giving more detail for how intimate the relationship was between Epstein and Wexner. And it links back to things like the Iran-Contra affair, the airline that was used in the Iran-Contra affair ended up doing work for Victoria's Secret, and there's this remarkable intermeshing of these spooks and people who are related to Israel, and there have been a whole series with the Epstein files that have come out, either through the government or have been, you know, hacked, the extent to which Epstein had incredibly intimate relationship with Israelis like Ehud Barak, and so on. So the it is quite clear that Epstein was acting very much on behalf of Israel a good deal of the time. I think there's a case to be made that he was an outright Mossad agent, but minimal coverage of that. And we're getting into this perverse situation, Dennis, where there's all of this coverage of the Epstein files, but without talking about Israel about it. So it's almost become a distraction from Gaza that's actually, in a way, about Gaza, but isn't hardly ever characterized as such by major media or by major political figures. That is, Israel is continuing to have carte blanche from the U.S. government to attack when it sees fit, and it's getting minimal coverage, even though there's coverage of the Epstein scandal, but the Epstein scandal is rarely being depicted as being meaningfully connected to Israel, even though it very much is.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Sam Husseini. Sam is an analyst. He works with the Institute for Public Accuracy. He does his own, a good amount of his own writing, blogging. You have been getting into issues that have to do with an icon of the left. Maybe you're going to make a few enemies here, but do you want to talk about your thoughts about Noam Chomsky, I guess, and Israel policy, as well as he did have a friendship with Epstein?
He was fairly unapologetic about it. I should say, I would refer people to my writing on Substack. People can get to it at Husseini.org. I speak for myself here and not any institution that I'm affiliated with. People were surprised by Chomsky's affiliation with Epstein. I mean, the thing that made a splash on, Twitter and other platforms in the last week or so is that I think some of these pictures had already come out, but they were released in such a way that they made a bigger wave of Chomsky on Epstein's plane, which is sometimes called the Lolita Express. I have no reason to believe that Chomsky was on his way to Epstein's island or anything like that. What I've seen indicates that it was just a plane, taking the plane from D.C. to New York or something like that. But nonetheless, there he is, and he's outright said, Chomsky has said in recent years that. That he makes no apologies about his affiliation, meeting and so on with Epstein. And Epstein actually brought him and, had a meeting between him and Barak, Ehud Barak, who I mentioned earlier, former prime minister of Israel. And, people are unsettled and, bewildered by this. Chomsky, Chomsky is a huge influence on me, as he is to a lot of people on the left, over the years, I've certainly, seen what I think are problematic aspects of Chomsky's worldview, and I'm sure that they delighted Epstein. Chomsky would always do his lesser evil voting stance, and in my eyes, that's a mechanism of keeping the genocidal duopoly in power in perpetuity, right? If every 4 years you go down this lesser evil voting stance, it's not going to change. His BDS stance, I remember hearing him on KPF A on debates, where he was effectively undermining efforts at doing boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel. And I think that that undermined a key tool for activists to hold Israel accountable. Again, I might be in a minority among some of your listeners here, but I, you know, during the pandemic, I underscored the dangers of lab work and decisions that were made about civil liberties there. And Chomsky was very much silent on the dangerous lab work, although I know he knew better. And he was embracing of many of the civil liberties infringements, in my view. He basically had a two-state stance. Again, with Chomsky, there's some certain nuance in the way he talks about things, but I think it's safe to say that in general, his stance seemed to favor a two-state thing solution, which is very difficult to see how that happens at this point, and a lot of activists are for a one-state solution, so it sort of undermined that. And his stance geopolitically in the region, like on Syria, it effectively helped undermine the Syrian government, and police, which was a major goal of U.S. and Israeli planners trying to destroy the axis of resistance. You can say that the Syrian government is oppressive, was oppressive, the government of Assad and the Ba'ath Party, but it was, as we see now, beyond any question, of something of a bulwark against Israeli expansionism. And we see now, with the fall of the Assad government, quite predictably, Israel moving further into Syria, Israel further asserting itself vis-a-vis Lebanon and other parts of the axis of resistance like Yemen. And finally, I've taken a good deal of time to really re-examine the JFK assassination in recent years. I would continuously ask members of Congress and at the State Department if they acknowledged the existence of Israel's nuclear weapons, and I mostly got evasions. I recently asked for O'Connor about that. He evaded it. I asked at the State Department. They evaded it. It's ridiculous. And as I've persisted in doing that, people brought to my attention that JFK really tried to stop Israel's nuclear weapons. He gave an ultimatum to Ben-Gurion, the founding prime minister of Israel, that if he didn't allow inspectors in, that that it would cause a complete reassessment of U.S. policy on Israel. And he, JFK, was also insistent on getting Palestinian refugees back to their homes. RFK, his younger brother and attorney general, was making a move on making what would become AIPAC a project of the American Zionist Council to register as a foreign agent. So he really threatened Zionist interests in these three critical ways. And there's substantial evidence of an Israeli role in the JFK assassination, in my view. I think this has been avoided by a good many people who have spent a lot of time on the JFK assassination.
Well, you're saying, just to underline, Israeli role in the JFK mm-hmm. assassination. I mean, it's sort of piles the traditional notion of conspiracy theorists on top of itself.
We can do a separate program if you like about it, but I mean, the central figure to this is James Angleton, who was the head of counterintelligence at the CIA, and he was also in charge of the Oswald file. He had Oswald tracked, including by Israeli operatives, in the years prior to the assassination. And he was also the liaison between the CIA and Israel. There's a monument to him in Israel, and he's largely credited with helping Israel obtain its nuclear weapons capacity that JFK was trying to stop. So there are many other aspects of evidence and individuals who were in Dallas and so on that I think that would sort of blow up this conversation into a much longer one. But I've written about this. People can see it, and I'm going to be writing about it in more detail. Monica Wiesack just had a very interesting book come out. Well, two books, actually. One on the last president, one on JFK's policies, and another on the assassinations. And she doesn't come to, she's an interesting writer. She doesn't come to any outright conclusion. She never says Israel did it, but she very fairly, I think, lays out the evidence. And I think, you know, if you really parse through the evidence, that there's a good deal. Anyway, going back to Chomsky, you know, yes, is kind of famous for dismissing that JFK would be significantly different from any other president. He made some remark about how, who cares, you know, if it was, you know, a jealous husband or anybody else, you know, which is kind of crazy to me. You know, if it causes the, you know, killing of somebody, well, it was a historic figure and could have affected the lives of millions, if not billions, of people, then you care. So that was another point at which I sort of feel like I parted ways with Chomsky. And so I put out a couple of posts on this just simply to tell people, you know, if you, you know, don't lose heart, you know, if you find that, you know, Chomsky is doing something you think is bad, that, you know, we shouldn't idealize people like this, and we should be able to retain our critical capacities and stick to, you know, principles, whatever the failings of one individual might be.
Again, you're listening to Flashpoints. We're talking with Sam Husseini. I want to let people know we were hoping to grab Anita Burrows to read us out with the extraordinary poetry that she has been writing all through the genocide, a poem every day. But I'm not sure. She's got a lot on the schedule today. I just tried to grab her. We have a little time, Sam, so I want to ask you, in terms of the situation, the atmospheric pressure, in terms of understanding, sympathy, support for the Palestinian cause, if you will, for, you know, continuing resistance to the genocide. In terms of the U.S., how do you see that at this moment? There's been a bunch of backpedaling. There's also, though, been that extraordinary election in New York City. And I'm wondering if that might have something to do with a continuing rise in resistance to the genocide, or are we going backwards? How do you see that in terms of where we are in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I think that there was a groundswell of popular support, including among, you know, young people and on campuses, but not limited to that at all. I think there was broad revulsion by the public, and I think that Mamdani benefited tremendously from that, as someone who was capable of saying that Israel's committing genocide and critical of it, and talking at one point about arresting Netanyahu if he tries to come to New York. But I'm very skeptical of political figures and institutions, and I'm not sure if he's going to follow through with any of that. I think that we have this sort of well-worn pattern of, you know, people in the Democratic Party making brave statements, from Obama to AOC to Sanders, and then they, you know, have some level of power, and occasionally they might do something good, but on balance, it's severely disappointing. So I feel like that's part of the pattern. We are seeing a lot of voices on the right in terms of quote-unquote influencers, which I think just simply reflect a human revulsion that, you know, goes across the political spectrum, right? So you're seeing people like Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens, you know, sounding increasingly critical of Israel, and apparently, you know, Charlie Kirk was, you know, beginning to do that before before his death. So you have, but I don't know how much, how serious they are. That, you know, I mean, I was talking before about Bethlehem and about, you know, the Latin patriarch, and so on. You would think, and you just had Tucker Carlson, you know, go to Doha to take part in, you know, a thing sponsored by Qatar, which he gets ragged on for. But you would think that somebody like him, who professes to be a very Christian and so on, that he might think of going to, say, Bethlehem on Christmas, you know, but that's not happening. So again, you don't know with these people, with these political figures and, you know, influencers who are obviously boosted on platforms like Elon Musk's X and otherwise, to what extent it's serious. And in a way, institutionally, the terrain has gotten worse, right? Well, you know, I mean, I spend way too much. My New Year's resolution, Dennis, is to spend less time on X. But it's got, in part because it's gotten worse and worse. Like right now, they hide graphic pictures from Gaza. They didn't used to do that. As of, you know, 3 months ago, that you would just scroll and you would see them. Now, you don't. You've got to click to see the image. We've seen the Ellisons take over CBS, put Barry Weiss, who the Palestinian poet Rafat al-Arir blamed his own impending death on, that she was fingering him as prime for assassination, and then he was assassinated. Barry Weiss, this political apparatchik, hyper pro-Israel, is now basically in charge of CBS. Which I think is designed to largely get an older demographic. And simultaneously, they've taken over TikTok USA, the Ellisons have, which I think is designed to undermine younger people getting real understanding of what's going on. So, you know, the whole TikTok ban thing, I don't think it was ever about a TikTok ban. I think it was about get the anti-Israel content out of there and find a pretext and find a deal that would do that. And they finally found a deal by getting Ellison, you know, made his fortune with Oracle, which was a CIA spinoff, a database company, and his son to be taking over more and more media to do that. So in some ways, the institutional factors are worse now, even though the public sentiment is I think it's even better now than it was, you know, during the first Intifada. People heralded that as, you know, a landmark break from the, you know, very pro-Israeli dominant narrative. I think this is an even more severe break. It's just, you know, will it be lasting, or will they chip away at it? I mean, Israel, there was recently a study that the Israelis, some pro-Israeli entity came up with, that basically said, we are depicted as an apartheid, you know, warmongering, war crimes entity, and the way around that is to talk about Islamophobia, right? They from a public management perspective, Israel sees that it doesn't have much of a case on its own merits. So its solution is to demonize Islam in the eyes of people in the U.S. as well as other countries, and that that's its ticket out. So I think those are some of the challenges we see.
Yeah, not to mention the ongoing expanding land snatch slaughter in the West Bank, which is definitely, you have to say, is out of control at this point in terms mm-hmm. of the expanding vigilante funding and what seems to be, you know, coming straight from the state. I was thinking you were talking about Bethlehem, Sam, and I am remembering correctly, as we hear approach Christmas and the Christmas spirit and all that, don't I remember at 1 year the Israelis shot the bell ringer out of the tower in Bethlehem just before
that.
Midnight?
I don't remember that. No, I mean, it could well have happened. I mean, it's, you know, it's, you know, no matter of the level just of criminality.
Interesting
it's
symbol.
Hard to keep up, so that could well have happened. And,
yeah. Yeah, somebody will let me know on that, I'm sure. To sum up, Sam, you're saying you're not hopeful, or you are? Or are we better off? Now than 2 years ago?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, there have been, you know, at minimum 70,000 Palestinians killed, and quite likely a couple hundred thousand. So that's horrible. You know, I think it's, I don't know, I try to be a real realist and just say, these are the things that are happening, and here are the opportunities. I mean, one thing that I've been moved by is what activists in England have done with Palestine Action, where they've directly gone into these Elbit Systems and other companies that are making munitions for Israel and literally bang them up. The British government not only arrests them, but anybody who signals any support for them. So people who hold up a sign that says, "I support Palestine Action," will get arrested. You just had Greta Thunberg arrested in London for doing this. Even people who, there was one fellow, I think he might have been a priest, who had a sign, "I don't support Palestine Action, but I oppose arresting people who do." And they arrested him. and now you have hunger strikers that are happening. People who are imprisoned are on hunger strike for that. And I don't know. I'm seeing some reports that it's getting quite serious in terms of the health of these people. And you got to remember the British. I mean, you said the people who, you know, let, you know, Bobby Sands and a bunch of other, you know, Irish freedom hunger strikers, you know, literally starve to death in their own prisons. So, I hate to think of a repeat of that, but I think if there's, you know, galvanized energy and a combination of direct action and legal recourse, that things can be moving meaningfully pushed back. That's sort of my assessment. I don't know if that's hopeful or not hopeful, but that's my sense of where things are.
Thanks. We thank you, Mr. Husseini. We wish you the best in
thank
all that.
Thank you, Dennis. Did you get Anita? Is she coming?
What's that? What?
I was wondering if Anita made it.
We didn't. I have to plead guilty. I didn't grab her soon enough. I don't think we're going to get her, but we're Anita Barrows, who has been writing a poem every day of the genocide, is continuing that work. I don't know why. Sam, say some stuff. I'm going to get up her latest poem. and read it. So you tell us something about why poetry is important for the people. And we're celebrating, you know, we're changing years. It's a new year. There's some hope. There's some despair, right? So talk to us. And I'm going to, I think I have her latest poem. I just don't have her. And that bugs me.
That's fair enough. I mean, I am not an Barrows Friedman. I wrote one poem this year. So let me read that while you look that up. If I got a minute here.
Okay. So I've got Anita. Are we in day 809? Is this 809? Do you know, Sam?
That sounds right.
Okay. Well, here is Anita's poem. I'm just going to read it, called Ceasefire 3, Day 74, Day 809. Your child has learned to distinguish the sound of an F-16 from the sound of a drone, the sound of a drone from the sound of a quadcopter. He has learned the difference between a bullet shot from an M16 and one shot from a tank or an Apache. What an education for a child of six, when he should have been learning to tell a triceratops from a velo. Oh my God, I'm screwing this up. We're gonna you read yours, Sam. I made a fool of myself.
No.
I can't. Well, you get the idea. I can't. I'm not gonna screw up the poem more. But talk to us. What do you got?
Tricopolis from a velo. Crop.
The potato. I'm good at cold readings.
A whale shark from a hammerhead. A sun conger from a macaw. I feel so silly because I don't know some of these things. I'm a little older than 6 years old. When we should have been learning how the sound of a cello differs from the sound of a violin. The sound a black bear makes, or a wild horse.
Yeah. Sorry. I promise Anita is going to be back on this show reading poetry, as she has all the way through this genocide. Sam, I thank you for your courage in trying a cold read. And also, I thank you for your courage in going to the State Department and trying to do the impossible, which is ask a real question and get a real answer and get brutalized for that. So this is why we appreciate you, Sam, and why we want to continue this dialogue. And you've been a wonderful addition to our information flow. So, yeah.
Well, it's so important to buttress and nourish and grow institutions like KPFA. Like I said, you know, it's not only the major media, but all, you know, the promises of, you know, what the technology would bring are shattering one by one. So it's crucial to nurture things like Flashpoints and KPFA.
Right. And Sam, it's an amazing place to work here. And I know that we've been mourning the loss of Barbara Lubin, who's the founder of the Middle East Children's Alliance, a most courageous soul for the people. We've had the honor to work with her. I know you know her work, right?
Absolutely. I remember being on I was visiting the Bay Area some, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and I remember being in studio with you and her and feeling slightly inadequate. she was such an incredibly gutsy woman. It was very inspiring.
As I've shared with people, I used to get calls from Barbara of all times of the day and night from the occupied West Bank and various places such as that. And sometimes I'd answer the phone and she'd be in the middle of a fight with a border guard, something right. about, are you shaving yet? You're pointing that gun at me? Who the hell do you think you, and fighting for the rights of people right on the ground and putting her body on the line.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. See ya, Sam. We'll talk to you. We'll bother you again real soon. Thank you for the poetry attempt reading. And we all apologize again, but we love the work and we love Free Speech Radio where we can even do that. Take care, Sam. And everybody else,
thank you,
we will be talking to you real soon. You're listening to Flashpoints. It's the Flashpoint Show on KPFA Pacifica Radio. We consider that the People's Radio Network since 1949, bringing you free speech, listener-supported, no-holds-barred, truth-to-power radio, KPFA in the Bay Area. Stay tuned.
That does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certified